If the attorneys could please turn their cameras on, I think we can go ahead and get started just a minute or two early. Are either of you waiting for someone to appear in the Zoom room that is not here yet?
No, Your Honor, not from the respondent.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, great. I will have the marshal call us to order again since we had a recess. Marshal, please go ahead.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Werke, Judge Smith, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's Wednesday, December 14th, 2022, and we have four cases on our calendar today, two of which are scheduled for oral argument. This is our second oral argument for today. As the marshal noted, I am Judge Wheelock and the presiding judge for today. I'm serving on a panel along with Judges Werke and Smith. This morning, we are holding our proceedings via zoom.gov. So allow me to address a few items before we begin. Oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings for these arguments will be available within about 24 hours on the Court of Appeals page at the Minnesota Judicial Branch's website. I also note that the rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or video recording of oral argument unless you have received the court's permission 24 hours in advance and agreed to comply with specific conditions as established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And with that, Marshall, please call the second case before us this morning.
This is case number A220877, Nicole Monique Collins, appellant, versus Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Human Services, respondent.
Attorneys, there is a clock in one square of your screen, and hopefully you can both see it. It will reset according to the time that you have for your argument. Please introduce yourself at the beginning of each argument so that our recording is clear and identify the client that you're representing. Please pronounce your name and your client's name. Let us know if there's any particular way you'd like us to refer to you or your client this morning. Also, please mute yourself, but leave your video on when you're not making argument. And finally, if anyone has any technical difficulties, please let us know right away and we will stop. We will pause the proceedings and try to help sort that out because we want to make sure we hear from all of you. So with that, counsel for appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Brianna Boone for the appellant, Nicole Monique Collins. May it please the court. Nicole Collins has nearly a decade of experience providing direct care to vulnerable individuals. The commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services has disqualified Ms. Collins from providing direct care and effectively shut Ms. Collins out of her career by relying on hearsay statements admitted through a constitutionally deficient procedure to find that Ms. Collins seriously maltreated a vulnerable adult by pushing them into a chair and causing bruises. The only evidence in this case that links Ms. Collins to this alleged push and the bruises are the uncorroborated, untested accusations of a single coworker who had been on the job for 2 days at the time of the alleged incident, Martina Halthus.
Ms. Boone, can you unpack a little bit about what happened with Halthus's not actually being there? I mean, we read the file and it seems to me that there is missing components. There was a subpoena that was served. Can you unpack that so I have a better understanding of what happened, why she wasn't, why the proceedings were not continued, why you didn't request a continuance, and so on?
Sure, Your Honor. So the Department of Human Services requested a subpoena for Ms. Halthus prior to the hearing. During the evidentiary hearing.
And as far as you know, it was served on her.
As far as I know, I don't work for DHS, so I don't know the particulars
but this is, in my experience in the trial court days, you have a subpoena personally served on someone, they don't show up as they're expected to do. You send somebody to go pick them up. And that's what bothers me about this case in your favor, that diminution of the due process right of confrontation. So that's why I want you to continue unpacking it for me so I understand.
Sure, Your Honor. So at the actual hearing, DH did not indicate why she was not present to testify. They moved forward with their case. We objected to admitting her statements through hearsay, and that objection was overruled. It did come, I think, in the transcript for the appeal below in district court. The attorney general mentioned that they maybe were not able to serve the subpoena because Ms. Holthus had moved out of state, but none of that was indicated on the record in the actual hearing.
And that's my problem as a reviewing court judge trying to figure out what happened, because I don't know if DHS, you know, decided to, knowing that they could not find their only witness, if that was their maneuver as far as putting hearsay evidence forward. You argue in your brief that you felt you didn't have any burden of production yourself. As far as the hearing was concerned, what she was listed as a witness. Did you do anything yourself in order to secure her testimony when you learned she was not going to be offered by DHS?
Sure, Your Honor. So the as you indicated, the burden of proving that Ms. Collins seriously maltreated a vulnerable adult in this case was on the agency. Under statute, they were required to prove that Ms. Collins pushed the vulnerable adult into a chair and caused bruises. It was not on Ms. Collins to disprove that. So Ms. Collins maintains that, you know, it was not her responsibility to call Ms. Holthus to prove DHS's case for them. And really the argument here is not so much that Ms. Collins was deprived of her right of confrontation, but that procedural due process required Ms. Holthus to testify because without her testimony, there really was a high risk that.
Sure. Okay. That was perhaps an overstatement as far as right of confrontation, but Collins testified?
Yes, Ms. Collins did testify.
And I'm looking at the balancing of interests. If Collins testified and there's a credibility determination made by the fact finder, how do they measure that against someone who's testimony is in reports? I mean, that's what you're arguing, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly, Your Honor. So the human services judge did make a determination that Ms. Holthus was more credible than Ms. Collins. But as you mentioned, Ms. Collins testified under oath and under cross-examination, whereas Ms. Holthus's story did not have to she didn't have to engage in any of those. So she had the benefit of not being there and testifying under oath. And our argument is that even though the human services judge did, I guess, make a credibility determination here, that determination was reached under a constitutionally deficient procedure in which Ms. Holthus really needed to be there to provide testimony, because the outcome of this case completely hinges on whether Ms. Collins or Ms. Holthus was telling the truth. It's live testimony is you know, beneficial in all cases, but there's some cases where the outcome is so dependent on the credibility of one witness versus another, where it becomes a necessity. And this is one of those cases.
Your client's cause is hurt because there was additional documents submitted. Weren't there photographs and so on? How were those explained?
Sure, Your Honor. So there is evidence that the vulnerable adult in this case did have bruises. But what DHS needed to prove in this case was that Ms. Collins caused those bruises, so that she pushed the vulnerable adult and that caused bruises. The bruises alone don't prove that Ms. Collins did anything. There was some evidence in the record that the vulnerable adult had unexplained bruises before. Additionally, there had been, you know, this incident wasn't reported until by Ms. Holthus until several days after it allegedly happened. So there were a few days between the alleged incident and documentation of the bruises where we don't really know what happened. So there is evidence that there are bruises, but that is not evidence that proves Ms. Collins seriously maltreated a vulnerable adult. Really, the only evidence that links Ms. Collins to serious maltreatment is Ms. Holthus's accusations against her. That's really the only evidence in the record that provides that link. And that is the key thing that needs to be proved in this case, is the link between Ms. Collins and the bruises. And since Ms. Holthus did not testify, there are several issues with her hearsay statements that were not tested under oath. So as I mentioned, there was a discrepancy with the timing of her report. Also, the record indicates that Ms. Holthus had stated that she initially didn't even connect this alleged push to the bruises until the person she reported to, Ann Piper, suggested that link. But the human services judge was not able to ask Ms. Holthus any questions about that because she didn't testify. There's also the matter of Ms. Holthus. This was her second or third day at the job, and there's no evidence to suggest she had worked with vulnerable adults before. So we don't know how her inexperience in this industry might have impacted her view of what happened. But because she wasn't there to testify, we don't know any of these things, and the human services judge was not able to flesh any of this out. And instead just relied on these uncorroborated, untested statements to decide that Ms. Holthus was more credible. And really there's a high risk that that credibility determination was wrong in this case. And since that is what the case hinges on, there's a high risk that the decision reached here was wrong. And that so that indicates that the second Matthews v. Eldridge factor on the procedural due process test really favors Ms. Collins's argument here.
Counsel, could you address the weighing of the three Matthews factors for us? It seems to me, as I looked at this and I thought about the government's interest, it appears the government's interest is in protecting particularly vulnerable adults, a very strong, very compelling interest. There's also a governmental interest in allowing these proceedings to move forward in a timely fashion, which I think is the basis for allowing hearsay testimony to be admitted at all under certain rules that are also cited in the briefs. But please address how the government's interest balances with the other two Eldridge factor, or Matthews factors for us. And is it possible that the government's interest could be so compelling that even if the other two factors weigh in Ms. Collins's favor, we would essentially find that the government's interest is overriding?
Sure, Your Honor. So there's no dispute that the government has a strong interest in protecting vulnerable adults or inefficient procedures. Ms. Collins is not arguing here that the department needs to call witnesses to provide testimony in every single one of these cases. The Matthews factors, as you mentioned, are a balancing test, and they are flexible and need to be considered on a case-by-case basis. So there might be some cases where DHS's interest in protecting vulnerable adults and efficiency weighs more than the other two factors. But in this case, the witness we are wanting DHS to call to testify was not a vulnerable adult herself. She was a staff member. Really, having her testify would not have harmed the vulnerable adult in any way. It would have just ensured that DHS was meeting their burden to prove their case here. And there's plenty of other hearsay evidence in this case that we're not objecting to. It's just this one piece of evidence that we think DHS needed to provide through live testimony. And really that is because the risk of erroneously depriving Ms. Collins of her right to her career is so high in this case, when the case hinges on whether this person was telling the truth. And Ms. Collins does have a strong interest in her career and in her reputation, which has been impacted. So in this particular case, Ms. Collins argues that those two factors clearly outweigh the burden on DHS.
Okay, so I have two questions. One is, doesn't the fact that the revocation of her license or her allowance to continue working in the area for only 7 years and the possibility that she could get an exemption of some kind, doesn't that actually reduce her interest or somehow change the balancing of the Matthews factors?
I don't think it changes it in a significant way, Your Honor. I mean, Ms. Collins has worked in this career for 10 years, basically her entire adult working life. So while she could technically go get another job, she's dedicated a decade to training and education and working in this career. And it's not a simple matter of her just going out and finding a new career. So I think that is her interest is still very strong, even though, yes, she could technically go get another job. And she does have the option to request the disqualification to be set aside, which she did in this as part of her evidentiary hearing, but that was denied. It's highly unlikely that the agency is going to set aside a disqualification based on a maltreatment determination that's, relatively fresh and only a few years old. So
these only apply to state operated facilities, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but I don't think there are not many fed, not state operated nursing, homes such as this, which is what Ms. Collins has worked in. And if she did move to another state, she would have to disclose that she had been found guilty of maltreatment. So it would still impact her ability to work in this career in other states as well, Your Honor.
Okay. And then my second question is, I want to be clear about what you're objecting to in terms of the reporting by Mrs. Holthus. So there is the testimony that she that came in through the investigator, I think, Investigator Tierney. And it seems clear to me that you are objecting, or that Ms. Collins is objecting, to that hearsay testimony coming in. Are you also objecting to the report that was made once Ms. Holthus worked with another supervisor or somebody else who came in to actually file a report reporting the incident and reporting Ms. Collins as the perpetrator of the incident?
Your Honor, we are objecting to all of Ms. Holthus's statements. In the transcript, I can point you to the site. I think it's document 16, which is volume one of the transcript, page 65. We note that our objection is to all of Ms. Holthus's statements ongoing. And then as well in our closing argument for the evidentiary hearing, which I think is document 19, volume 4, page 283, it is made very clear that we're preserving our objection to all of Ms. Holthus's hearsay statements. So the objection is to her report, and these are all summaries of things she said. So the summary of her initial report, the summary of what she said in the internal investigation, and the summary of her interview with DHS. And okay. I see that is my time, Your Honor.
Yes. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So now we'll add 15 minutes to the clock, and we will turn to counsel for respondent. Please begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I am James Schobrill, counsel for respondent, commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. May it please the court. This appeal is a substantial evidence case dressed up in procedural due process. The appellant was afforded a meaningful opportunity to be heard through the fair hearing process, including a full evidentiary hearing. An appellant does not claim that this process is unconstitutional. Appellant believes the commissioner relied solely on hearsay evidence in reaching her determination, but substantial evidence in the record supports the commissioner's determination even without the challenged hearsay evidence. And special statutes permit reliance on hearsay evidence in fair hearings and actually require acceptance of the type of challenged hearsay evidence in this case. These special statutes are set up in part because we're dealing with a vulnerable population and vulnerable adults. And this hearsay evidence corroborates all of the other evidence and findings in this case. This court should affirm because appellant has not been deprived of procedural due process. The commissioner's consideration of this hearsay is not arbitrary and capricious, and substantial evidence supports the maltreatment and disqualification determinations. I'm going to begin briefly by touching on procedural due process, and then I will discuss the arbitrary and capricious issue along with the substantial evidence issue, which are somewhat interrelated. So first, the commissioner did not deprive Ms. Collins of a procedural due process. All procedural due process requires is a notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard. The fair hearing statutes, the constitutionality of which appellant does not challenge, afforded her a meaningful opportunity to be heard. She was represented by-
If I may, just if for a hypothetical, if there was a situation where the only evidence of any abuse of a vulnerable person was a person's eyewitness testimony as to what happened, there's no, you know, there were no, that's it. There were no physical, you know, marks or anything like that. It was just a person reported that. And then the department doesn't bring that person forward and instead just brings in a hearsay, you know, statement from that person of what they saw. Doesn't that start to run into a due process problem considering that it's a department's burden?
The department's burden, Your Honor, in this case is preponderance of the evidence as set forth by the statutes. And I would argue that appellant kind of looks at this issue too narrowly. It's not necessarily reliance solely on hearsay evidence if you accept the appellant's position. Really what it is the commissioner may rely solely on commonly accepted evidence that's commonly accepted by reasonable people in the conduct of their affairs. So if the hearsay evidence is reasonable, is commonly accepted by reasonable people in the conduct of their affairs, if that's a determination that the department makes under the unique circumstances of the hypothetical you propose, and that's something that, you know, the human services judge can weigh that evidence against, you know, other evidence in the record, including maybe other testimony or so forth, you know, and
so even if it were dependent on a single statement, hearsay statement, if the department or court, I guess, reviewing it could look at that and decide that it's that statement has some indicia of reliability. So even though the department didn't bring that person forward, that single statement can be sufficient basis, even though that person's not a witness.
I think, Your Honor, that would be up to the determination of the judge. In this case, the human services judge, for example, did look at the hearsay evidence that was presented through Ms. Holthus, and in her findings specifically said this was not the best evidence. It would have been better to have an audio recording. It would have been better to have her testify. It would have been better, you know, it listed a number of reasons of better evidence that would have been presented. And of course, the commissioner does prefer and relying on the best evidence of the case. But if it doesn't, if the best evidence is not available, then it's up to the human services judge to determine based on.
Mr. Sherbel, here's my question then. And of course, you know, we give great deference to the agency's expertise and it's fact finding, and we don't interfere unless you're relying on evidence that's inherently unreliable. What does that mean to you? What's inherently unreliable? Is there, can you point to anything that would give us some definition or some ability to discern what is intended by that?
Your Honor, that's thank you. I don't believe I know the answer to that question. I think in my brief, we cited that I didn't see a specific legal authority that defined inherently unreliable evidence in that regard. I will note too, and I know Judge Werke, you had some questions about unpacking Ms. Holthus's.
Well, before you unpack then, on that inherently unreliable, do you think this case even merits or warrants having any kind of precedential effect that we should delve into that?
I don't, Your Honor. I would suggest an unpublished opinion in this case. I do agree. I think Your Honor cited it well, that there are some unclear records. It wasn't fully developed at the fair hearing, the basis for Ms. Holthus's non-appearance. And so I think there's some questions that are left unanswered that would not really render this case suitable for a precedential opinion. In terms of that, though, you know, looking at the human services judge's order, it does indicate in there that I think the verbiage is essentially that the department did not call or decided not to call Ms. Holthus. And so I wasn't at the hearing. It may have been that she wasn't actually served. It may have been that she was served the subpoena and then they tried to contact her in advance and they decided ultimately not to call her. I do know that the witness list for the department it did include Ms. Holthus, but it also included a statement that merely including a witness on the witness list did not compel or require their attendance.
But that therein is the problem. Perhaps she was the worst witness ever and was very unreliable. And that's my concern. Can you were going to unpack my concerns about the subpoena and so on. Can you add anything to that?
Your Honor, I was going to just elaborate kind of what I did right now. I think that there's really, you know, I think there's, I agree with what Ms. Boone counsel for appellant Ms. Boone mentioned. I think that there's, the record only indicates essentially that I think Ms. Holthus was moving at the time or had moved. And so, you know, I could her testimony would have been counter to what DHS was trying to prove. You know, for example, maybe she lost her papers in the move. Maybe she didn't have internet set up yet. Maybe she just in the bustle of the move, she kind of lost track of the timing of the hearing. All of those things were never fleshed out in the record, Your Honor. I will note though, Your Honor, so I think one of the principal cases that appellant relies on in this matter is the EJW case. And I would like to touch briefly on that one in terms of deprivation of erroneous deprivation of protected interests. So EJW is a case in which the student faced expulsion for alleged participation in a bomb threat. The only evidence in that case the school district presented was hearsay testimony from law enforcement officers who actually investigated the incident based on the statements that they received from unidentified student witnesses. So the principal concern in EJW was depriving the student of his opportunity to confront these adverse witnesses, these unidentified student witnesses. So I think there's some confusion. Appellant in the reply brief contends that EJW holds that the school district had to call the student witnesses, but that's not what this court held. After acknowledging that the district court had the burden of proof in production, right after making that statement, this court said, but if the district court was not going to call the students as witnesses, EJW was entitled to have their names before the hearing, so his attorney would have an opportunity to investigate and compel their presence by subpoena if that was deemed necessary to present an adequate defense. And that's at pin site 781 of the EJW case. And so the important point to make here is that the fair hearing statutes, again, the constitutionality of which are not being challenged, provide exactly the type of protections that EJW was concerned about. And those protections include, you know, before the hearing, appellant had an opportunity within a reasonable time before the hearing to review the department's case file. Appellant had the opportunity to issue subpoenas for documents or witnesses if the appellant thought they were necessary to present an adequate defense. So in this case, the appellant had reviewed all the documents, saw everything in there that Ms. Holthus was stating. And if appellant believed that an adequate defense required the testimony or being able to confront Ms. Holthus as a witness, then appellant could have had the opportunity to subpoena her. Appellant did present her case at the full evidentiary hearing, including her own opportunity to testify and offer evidence. And as this court has held in the Fosselman case, all of those procedural safeguards are all that due process requires. I would like to touch briefly on substantial evidence in the record, if I may.
In doing so, I think it would be helpful, let's say for the sake of argument, that we agree that the hearsay evidence should not have been considered. I'm interested to hear what other evidence you believe was relied upon in the administrative judge coming to their decision.
Yes, Your Honor.
What could we look to in that regard?
Certainly, Your Honor. So I think that there are three key findings that the human services judge made that the commissioner accepted. And two findings, essentially. The first finding is it was more likely than not the appellant lost patience with this vulnerable adult whose name is AL and got into a power struggle with AL while AL wanted to go into her room to change her clothes on the date in question. The judge also found it was more likely than not that the appellant caused the bruises by grabbing AL by the arms and forcing her to sit down in the chair. So there's to your Honor's question, there is substantial non-hearsay evidence that supports these findings. For example, it's undisputed that on the date in question, there was an encounter between the appellant and AL during which the appellant resisted AL's efforts to change her clothes. That's testimony from the appellant. There's also no dispute that the appellant and AL had physical contact during this encounter. It's also undisputed that at one point the appellant was standing in the doorway to AL's bedroom, and appellant appreciated that this could have been interpreted as blocking AL from entering her own bedroom. There's also non-hearsay evidence showing that the appellant wanted AL to sit into the dining room chair. I think appellant herself testified that she directed or asked the vulnerable adult to sit in the dining room chair. There's also hearsay evidence, I suppose, but unobjected to hearsay evidence by the facility's program director that stated that appellant doesn't handle stress very well and gets into power struggles. To that point, appellant testified that her home life was stressful and the performance review that she submitted as an exhibit indicated that she should work on handling her stress better and not allowing that stress to affect her at work. Furthermore, AL did suffer bruising, and there's undisputed evidence that that bruising was on her buttocks and arm, which is consistent with the story. If you don't accept that hearsay evidence, is consistent with the concept of being pushed or grabbed and then pushed into a chair. There's also evidence from the investigator who reviewed all of AL's medication that none of the medication, it would have been unusual for that medication to have caused bruising. There's no documentation written anywhere that AL fell or otherwise injured herself, before or during this incident or around this time. And as I mentioned, there's also live testimony at the hearing from the appellant and the investigator Tierney, and there were credibility determinations made by the human services judge as to that testimony. And in particular, the human services judge found that the appellant's version of events tracks in all major ways with what Ms. Holthus reported, but it was a sanitized version. In other words, Ms. Holthus' story matches up very closely with everything. Ms. Holthus just denies that she actually pushed her into the chair, but there's no other explanation for how that would have happened. Certainly all of this evidence is sufficient beyond a preponderance of the evidence and based on the credibility determinations that the human services judge made at the hearing to support the disqualification determination. As I mentioned, I do believe special statutes in this case permit consideration of hearsay. So I want to emphasize again briefly that it is not the respondent's position that hearsay evidence was solely relied upon for any of these findings, but the hearsay evidence is something that the commissioner consider, and that hearsay evidence corroborates all of the other evidence in the record. And that hearsay evidence includes Ms. Holthus reporting to the facility that she observed the appellant push AL into the chair. And that when Ms. Holthus brought this up, brought the bruising up to the appellant said, don't worry about it. And, you know, change the vulnerable adult from wearing a short sleeve shirt to a long sleeve shirt. So there's some of those things. I know there's some question about some inconsistencies in certain aspects of Ms. Holthus's statements that were made. I think those inconsistencies are immaterial. There's no question Ms. Holthus has never been inconsistent about the fact that she saw appellant push AL into the dining room chair. So in sum, Your Honor, if there are no other questions, the commissioner contends that she did not deprive appellant of procedural due process, that admitting and considering the hearsay evidence was not arbitrary, capricious, and that substantial evidence supports the commissioner's maltreatment and disqualification determinations. The commissioner respectfully asks that this panel affirm. Thank you very much. I yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you. We will get the clock reset for rebuttal. And when that's done and you are ready, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I just want to address a couple of points in my reply. So the respondent argues that because the fair hearing statute allows hearsay to be admissible, that it provides, you know, admitting hearsay in this instance was sufficient under the Constitution. The procedural due process has to mean something. It has to provide a guardrail to the fair hearing. And there's no dispute that hearsay can be admitted, but there's a line somewhere where that might cross the line in violating procedural due process. And Ms. Collins is arguing that this is that case because DHS had the burden of proving maltreatment in this case, and their case, they have no case without Ms. Holthus's story. So the argument here is that while yes, hearsay is admissible in fair hearings, in this case, procedural due process required live testimony.
Do you have any legal authority or cases that would be on point in regards to the statements you've just made that would be helpful for us to have?
Sure, Your Honor. So, I mean, obviously Matthews v. Eldridge is the key case and it has the balancing test that, you know, you would apply the factors here. Nothing in Matthews v. Eldridge says that if a statute says something is admissible, then, you know, procedural due process doesn't apply. Also, respondent mentioned the EJW case, which does provide some guidance on this issue. That was a case about a school expulsion, so it is a little different, but the facts are very similar. That was a case where the district's argument that the student made an alleged bomb threat was completely based off of these hearsay statements of a student. And they found that really the decision maker needed to see those students testify so they could make a credibility determination and figure out what happened in the case. Also, I would point to Fosselman v. Commissioner. I think that is another maltreatment case. There's a lot of language in that case that supports that maltreatment cases are very fact intensive and hinge on the credibility of witnesses. And I think if you take Fosselman along with EJW, there's support that there could be cases where hearsay is not going to be sufficient in a fair hearing. And then I would just want to point out that despite respondents' arguments otherwise, there is not substantial evidence in this case supporting the commissioner's decision without Ms. Holthus's statements. There's nothing in this case that links Ms. Holthus to the push and the bruises without Ms. Holthus's story. Ms. Collins's testimony about a conflict with the vulnerable adults has nothing to do with whether she pushed the vulnerable adult into a chair and does not prove that the alleged push caused the bruises. There's no substantial evidence in this case without those statements. And then finally, if this court does determine that Ms. Holthus's hearsay statements were admissible and were not admitted in violation of constitutional due process, Ms. Collins argues that there's still not substantial evidence to support the case because those hearsay statements were inherently unreliable. As we've already discussed, Ms. Holthus was subpoenaed and decided not to testify. For whatever reason, we don't know why she didn't testify. Also, there's discrepancies about the timing of her report and the potential influence of what she saw by Ms. Piper, who was a supervisor. All of those things indicate that this hearsay was unreliable. And even if it could have been admitted to the fair hearing, it was not sufficient basis for the commissioner to rely on to reach the decision. And with that, Ms. Collins respectfully requests that this court reverse the commissioner's decision that Ms. Collins seriously maltreated a vulnerable adult and is disqualified from direct care because the commissioner reached that determination in violation of Ms. Collins's right to procedural due process. Thank you, Your Honor. I yield the rest of my time.
Thank you to both counsel for argument this morning and for the briefs that you submitted. They were very helpful to us. The case is submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the statutory timeframe. And with that ends this morning's oral calendar, and we are now in recess.